Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications is in order. Today we're going to have an overview or review from the Department of Commerce. And welcome to our new Commissioner of Commerce, Commissioner Rothman. So you've been, 6 days on the job or so?
Well, I think it's three and a half.
Three and a half, okay. I was counting the weekend there.
Yeah,
so.
Right. Well, I did work the weekend too, yes.
Okay. And we also have Deputy Commissioner Munson Regalia. Welcome. And I think we'll probably just start with an overview. And members, if you have any questions, Commissioner, do you mind if they ask you midstream? We will be talking a lot about the Office of Energy Security, which directly affects this division. We'll be talking about some of the federal funds, some of the baseload energy needs for the state, and just a variety. But if you'd like to start with your handout here, we have slides and a little handout. So, and if you could state your name
Sure.
for the records. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Rothman, Commissioner of Commerce. I know some and a few of you, so first of all, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come here today. Even though there's only been a few days started, I think hitting the ground running with the session starting, with the issues that we have to deal with during the session, and as well as what we need to do for the state of Minnesota is important. And that's my goal, is to start off quickly and as seamlessly as possible.
Well, so. Commissioner, you're not new to the Capitol, though.
No.
I understand you've been here before.
That's right.
So. Yeah,
that's
good.
Right. That's yeah. Great. In fact, I may know a lot of the nooks and crannies from 15, 20 years ago. So, but yes,
secrets.
I do. So let me start off, though, first of all, with introducing the staff that are with me here today. First of all, we have Manny Munson-Regalia. Manny is assisting with helping me in organizing the office and all that and getting ourselves started. Also, as many of you know, Bill Glahn, Deputy Commissioner, is here. With us, we also have various assistants and program managers to help answer some of your questions. John Hervanko is Energy Assistance Program Manager and oversees the LIHEAP program. We also have Kate O'Connell, Energy Regulation and Planning Manager. Kate's back here. If you would just raise your hand. Steve Rockow is here, Energy Regulation and Planning Staff. We also have Larry Hartman in that area as well, Energy Facilities Permitting Staff. All right. Behind the screen, hiding.
He's hiding.
Then we also have Janet Streff, the State Energy Office Manager. And with Janet's division, we have Jeremy DeFebra, who's the State Energy Program Supervisor. And Jeff Haas, Conservation Investment Program Supervisor. So we have a pretty strong team. And also we have Vince Chavez here, Special Assistant to the Deputy Commissioner. As we go along, if questions come up, we'll try and address those, and maybe the staff will too. But also, I want to assure you that if you have questions, we will maybe take them back and get you the answers to some of your questions. So with that, I'd like to start off with our presentation. The overall mission of the Office of Energy Security, which is housed within the Department of Commerce, is to promote reliable, affordable, and environmentally sound energy for Minnesota citizens and businesses. These are the key overriding structures. They're statutory, they're requirements in the law, but also they form the function or the foundation for the philosophy and mission of the Office of Energy Security. With that, I'd like to also say and step back. As I step into my office and my responsibilities in the Department of Commerce, I take it very seriously to do what we can to look at the public interest. We're all Minnesotans. We all want to look at the issues. We have some very big issues that we're looking at. And from that perspective, it's my responsibility in the executive branch to look at things broadly and in terms of everyone's interests. But also within that, as you know, is a consumer protection function. And with that, we also look at and take seriously the importance of giving businesses the opportunity to succeed in the economy and come out of the recession and do what we can to provide the energy and resources for businesses and for consumers so that they can survive either as homes or as businesses and do well in the economy. We do not want to lose track of that, and it's very important. We also take a broad, look and seriousness at our regulatory function. We are a regulatory agency, and as anybody here at the table would too, if you were sitting in my my chair and my role, look at the regulatory function as well. With that, let me turn to some of the other broad issues. As you see, we're primarily focused on being an advocate for the public interest before energy regulatory bodies. Number two, another significant responsibility is to promote energy efficiency and clean energy technologies through policy initiatives, financing programs, and technical assistance and public information. The third thing that we have within the Office of Energy Assistance is to help low-income Minnesotans afford energy costs through energy assistance and weatherization. As you'll see as we get into this, energy assistance and weatherization are significant programs within our department. So to drill down a little bit, in the Office of Energy Security, there are five units. We have energy regulation and planning, energy facilities and permitting, the energy assistance program, there's the state energy office, and the reliability administration and other aspects. All of these are pieces within the Office of Energy Security, and as we had introduced the staff to put faces to these functions in these units, these are the folks at the management level that are sitting with us today. To give you kind of an overview, a very broad overview, without delving down into the, you know, basic, into the details and dollars, we just wanted to give you a broad perspective of where the budget and the monies come from for the office. As you see, the federal dollars are $376,500,000. There's special revenue of $19.5 million and general fund revenue of $5.98 million. The next slide is to say, okay, well, where is that money and how does it work within our department? As you'll see, the Energy Assistance Program constitutes $330 million of the overall sources. The Energy Regulation and Planning is $4 million. The Reliability Administration and other is $2.2 million. And then we have the State Energy Office. That is $60 million, and of that, there are ERA funds of $30 million. The energy facilities and permitting is $6 million. So you can see a large portion of the funding sources and the the units and responsibilities comes from federal dollars.
And, Commissioner, of course, those federal dollars, the ERA dollars, are up when?
Well, predominantly, most of them are being digested now. Mm-hmm. And as we go through it, let me just say it this way. It's my goal as I step into the office to make sure that the funding, some of it is stimulus money in the weatherization area, and in particular also in the LIHEAP area. When those dollars come in, they need to be efficiently and quickly put into the economy, and that's my goal, and I believe you'll see that is what's happening. I think the bulk of it is being digested, and it's happening and being implemented into the economy. Mm-hmm. Stepping back now to these priorities for our department, in energy regulation and planning, its overall purpose and function is to be an advocate for Minnesota's public interest to ensure some basic things, that the rates utilities charge to consumers are fair and reasonable, that the utilities integrated resource plans, IRP for short, considers supply and demand resources reasonably and according to Minnesota laws, and that utilities fairly consider alternatives to building new facilities. in the rate case area, and that's another, we have their staff that's devoted to that function. As you can imagine, these cases are quite complex, and many of you probably have the experience in working on these or have constituents or stakeholders that are involved in these areas. They're very complex cases for analysis and modeling in terms of the financial and accounting, statistical, and cost allocation matters. We have unbelievable staff, very sophisticated, who take all the information, work with the stakeholders, and develop that into the rate cases. They also consider and balance financial needs of utility service with the financial burden on utility customers. They ensure energy service is reliable, costs are reasonable and fair, and encourage conservation. With that, we have resource plans and the certificates of needs. Overall, these are just sort of broad overview for you to take a look at. Plans have an overall 15-year plan for a new generation. You may have seen this, but there have been studies and some planning for generation needs for Minnesota. Highly detailed and very sophisticated models and analysis that are done. There is also the certificates for proposed facilities. And the next bullet point, we look at the whole process requires sophisticated modeling. It takes into account the size, type, and timing of the energy needs for our economy, for the needs of customers and the stakeholders. They identify the lowest cost supply options and demand management alternatives. Now, we thought it would be good just to kind of give you examples of this. There are other big examples recently. But just to put sort of a face on what we're dealing with and the kinds of work that day-to-day the staff are working with. For example, a recent rate case, there was a requested $88.9 million annual rate increase by a utility. Our staff and OES did an analysis and did some testimony in that rate case. In order to do that, it took 3,661 staff hours and $340,000 staff in legal costs. And we point that out because, staff needs and resources are critical in order to achieve and to accomplish these. But the results are important, too, to take a look at, which you'll see in the next bullet point. And based on the OES recommendations that the office made, the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, approved in this case a rate increase that it was $27 million less than requested, which is an overall savings. So the investment of the time and resources that the staff put into that does generate results.
Commissioner?
Yes.
Senator Jim Brown?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. So as we're looking through some of these issues, help us to understand how you work alongside of PUC to give them information and where, PUC would take over so that we understand the significant differences there?
Well, the staff of our department is really in advocacy, we can have them come up here and talk a little bit about that. But the idea generally is that the PUC is quasi-judicial in a way and reviews rates in the cases that's all presented. They make the final decision. The OES is a department that gives input, basically, in the process, and from an advocacy standpoint, from the public interest, gives the information to help the PUC make those decisions. It's an interesting question because not only because the department and the OES has various functions, that's an advocacy thing, but also that we step back and there's a planning function. But in the rate case area, strong staffing, step into it and they go through a lot of analysis. Kate's here. Kate, do you want to take a crack at getting into? Kate is absolutely fabulous and can give you a little bit more in detail on how the staffing works and that in the interface with the PUC.
Please state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. I'm Kate O'Connell, the manager of Office of Energy Security, and with that introduction, I hope I can live up to part of it. To your question about our role with the Public Utilities Commission, we're an independent agency from the Public Utilities Commission, but we make recommendations directly to them. And we know when we make recommendations to the commission, our recommendations have to be able to hold up in court, because we think beyond, even beyond the commission's decision, to the utility's ability to take the decisions that the commission makes to court. So we take very seriously not only our work, but the work of the commission. So we want to make sure that the recommendations that we make are solid recommendations. In this case, by and large, the commission accepted all of the OES's recommendations. So it was based on our testimony, our forecasting, our accounting analysis, a forensic accounting, and all of the questions that we asked the utilities over and over again, not repeated, but just to dig into the issues as far as we can, that formed the solid basis for the commission to be able to make the decisions that they made that resulted in $27 million annual reduction for those customers. That reduction stays in place until the company files its next rate case. So the cost for my staff's time is a one-time cost. The savings, it's an annual savings that continues till the company files again.
Senator Jumbo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. O'Connell, that's it's a good explanation. And just help me understand, too, then, what you do that does help the PUC. The PUC doesn't have staff that can go through the same kind of exercise, or they don't, so there's no duplicity in this process?
Do you mean, Madam Chair and Senator Jungbauer, duplication?
Right.
Senator Jungbauer.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, so I see where this is very helpful to the rate payers and very helpful to the PUC, but I'm needing to understand that the PUC doesn't actually have staff that does the same thing, so we're not duplicating a process in terms of all this information and gathering.
Ms. O'Connell.
Chairwoman, Senator, we have separate functions. Our function is to investigate, to do the analysis, to come up with proposals. The commission staff function is to look at the analysis of all of the parties in a case. So it may not be only the OES who is involved in a case. There may be other entities that are involved. Commission staff then has to take all of the information that's in the record to provide for the commissioners the, you know, background to say, well, OES may have said this, but another entity said that. So our role is an advocate. The commission staff's role is to provide briefing for the commissioners before they make their decision.
Senator Jungbauer.
And Madam Chair and Commissioner Ms. O'Connell, thank you very much. And I think it's extremely important in this kind of a budgetary situation that we understand the distinct lines, the distinct roles, and we understand, you know, what the consumer is getting for that investment. So I think it's good. And I'm kind of going through this line of questioning to be sure that as you're doing your presentation, you're giving us those lines of distinction so we understand and we can get this all figured out. So thank you very much.
Senator Brown.
Yes, I want to go back to the Office of Energy Security slides and the third of $1 billion that's labeled Energy Assistant Program.
Yes.
Who are the recipients of that money and what are some examples of how that's used?
Well, you know, we're going to, Madam Chair and Senator Brown, later on I'll get into that. We can jump to that, but I have a few slides that we can get to and answer all your questions.
Thank you.
But off the top, in particular, is it the low-income heating and energy assistance program, or is it weatherization that's your focus?
Senator
well,
Brown?
I just see – thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I just see that figure of $30 million, and I'm just wondering who's the recipient
of that.
All right,
well, we can break that down. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll get to that, and if you don't mind, we'll continue on.
Fine, thank you.
We'll address your question.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, can you just tell me, it looks like we have significant staff hours there and 340,000 hours of the staff and legal costs. What once a rate case is decided, how long does a utility need to wait to bring it back, or is there a significant effect factor, or is there a time frame, or can you explain that once we've invested this amount of money?
Well,
Commissioner Rothman,
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, I'd ask Kate to come back up, but Are you asking for an appeal process, or just to clarify your question, or is it in a year or two to come back and address their rates so that they can address the...
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, just let's say that the PUC, in this case, said it's $27 million less.
Yeah.
And not an appeal process, but just for a utility to come back and say, well, now we do need to increase our rates.
Sure.
Is there a significant event factor, or is there a time frame? Or is this a revolving door? I'd just like to have some understanding
sure.
of that.
Kate?
Commissioner Rothman or Ms. O'Connell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, Senator, what I would say is that there in statute, there is a certain amount of time. I believe it's 90 days from the time that the commission makes its final decision before a utility could file. But utilities do not want to come in and file another rate case. There was a long period of time in the 1990s mostly, when some utilities had been out for 20 years before they came back in for a rate case. Sometimes the utilities come in more frequently, maybe every 3 years, depending on their needs. What we're thinking will be the case in the next decade or so is that utilities may come in for rate cases more frequently, say every 3 years, than, for example, a 20-year hiatus. And that's because utilities are now building facilities that they haven't built for a long time, such as transmission. And when they make those investments, they will likely want to recover those costs in their rates. But the decision is ultimately the utilities to make, unless the commission calls them in specifically.
Does this coordination with the rate cases, with the PUC, does this extend to siting and routing also? Or is that a different, a completely different beast?
The siting and routing also, I hesitate to talk very much about that. That's outside of my group. That is, Deb Pyle is the manager of that group. But I know that the siting and routing people work with the Public Utilities Commission. I don't want to say exactly how everything works because I think it'd be better if she responded to that.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair, we get into some of the permitting process in a few slides here as well.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Quinn. Go ahead, Commissioner.
All right. What do we have up? Okay. So we'll go to the next slide, which is the energy facility. It's sort of a great segue, Madam Chair, into the permitting process. The we have the unit that does energy facilities permitting, and then we set out some of the primary responsibilities here in this slide. To develop environmental review record that supports a prudent siting and routing of proposed projects. It also manages the permitting process for the siting and routing of large energy facilities. And it serves as a technical staff to the PUC. However, it does not in that role, it does not advocate for or against particular projects. And so that gets back to a little bit of, as I was indicating earlier to Senator Jungbar, there is, in different areas, different functions that the, you know, each of these little units, they're not little, the units work on. In the next slide, we give you sort of an overview of recent activity in the permitting area. What you don't see here is, let me just step back a little bit, is historically, this represents an uptick in the amount of permitting activity. Historically, a little time before that, it was, I don't have the figures in front of me, but the permitting process in order to achieve some of the recent permitting applications and as well the current reviews are generally an uptick to address some of the concerns or the activities in the energy area. So, for example, in 2010, there were 19 facility reviews completed, and we've broken those out. One power plant, one pipeline, 8 transmission lines, and 9 wind facilities. And as you can imagine, these are in order to bring online the infrastructure for some of the for our energy generation needs as well as the transmission needs. And then in the next bullet, we set out here for you just a general, to tell you that we have 13 active reviews right now in the department. And so this is a little bit of a carryover, but the workload is relatively significant. There are 7 transmission lines under review. I don't know the exact number the staff does, but this represents some of the new CapEx 2020 project process. And then we also have 6 wind facilities that are currently in the pipeline for review at this time.
Commissioner, what is a wind facility? Is there a minimum megawatt for a facility?
Good question.
Over 50?
Let me ask staff. 100? Let me ask staff to come up and address that. As we go through the process, it's for me, it's a good question. We're delving down into that, but I think it also varies, Madam Chair, from project to project, and depending upon, you know, what that utility wants to do, where it's located, and all that. But we'll get you that.
Thank you.
Answer.
Please state your name.
Larry Hartman, Office of Energy Security. Chairman Rosen, in response to your question, review starts for wind facilities at 5 megawatts. And between 5 and 25, it can either be permitted by the state or counties that assume jurisdiction can also regulate those facilities. Above 25 megawatts, it would need a site permit from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission.
Thank you. Any other questions in committee?
We'll turn in anything on permitting, because we're going to turn into a different topic, and I know maybe transmission or permitting might be on people's mind. But let me just emphasize this in terms of my general, as I come into this, stepping back sort of from, 20,000 feet. We have a lot of significant energy issues, reliability, safety, security, and all that, but we cannot lose sight of transmission. Transmission, as you'll see, and basically in our studies and as we forecast this, is very important for none of us to lose sight of the fact that transmission is a key, is a linchpin of our economy, linchpin for all of the customers, both homeowners and businesses, but as well for the utilities, because in order for us to achieve, let's say, base load generation and to get the energy to where we want it to be, either in the renewable area as we develop that renewable area or whatever we deal with, transmission is a critical infrastructure need for the state. Now, some of that is already being digested, but when you get into your work, I want you to make sure that you're keeping your, you know, review strategically out to 2020 and 2030, so that we make sure that, you know, we're meeting the needs of our state and start thinking about that today. At least it's on my radar screen.
So, Commissioner, 3 days on the job, what your general impression or opinion on the state of Minnesota's progress in that area in transmission?
The question.
Yep, your honest opinion.
Before
government taints you.
We have a lot, and there are you can see. Can you see the faces behind and what they're? Oh, what is he going to say?
Exactly.
Here's the bottom line. I believe if you look at the forecasting for the next 10 years, you will find that that there will be challenges in order to meet our transmission needs. How we get there is going to be a lot of questions will be needed to be asked. You know, resources, where are the needs geographically, what are the permits that we're talking about right now, what are the specific needs of the utilities and where are they? We also have to look at and keep a broad sight about the regional issues in terms of, what opportunities do we have as a state, either as, you know, to develop energy and utilize our energy opportunities. We need those transmission facilities to achieve some of that. So my basic view is that I think if you look at what our staff will tell you is that transmission is going to, we need to invest in the infrastructure and transmission so that we can achieve what we need to do as an economy in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and without it, we will have a very difficult time. And then that would lead us into issues, I shouldn't say issues, but the opportunities for smart grid development, and some very broad thinking about that. I know the nation is looking at that, but I also think that we can't lose sight of that in Minnesota to bring in experts, to have utilities at the table, to have in academics who are very bright in this area, and as well as our own staffing to take a look at those kinds of. I don't want to be pie in the sky either, but I don't mean to say that, but I think we all need to, take the moment, look at what we're doing today so that in 20, 30 years from now, we do what we need to do to have those opportunities for future generations. Mm-hmm. But then to focus really back on the point I was making is that I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that we will need investment in transmission infrastructure. At least that's my opinion, mm-hmm. being 3 days on the job.
Well, you know, Commissioner, you come from the private sector, and it's that very well respected. So appreciate your viewpoint. If we're missing anything that we haven't seen, what you're hearing out there in the field, please let us know.
We will. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So let me
excuse me, Commissioner. Senator Jungbauer.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. And as you're talking about transmission and you know, partly for the new folks here, but really in the general public, when I'm out there, one thing the public doesn't get when we're talking about meeting the renewable energy standard is that you just can't hook energy projects any place there's a line. You just can't hook on and transfer that power. So I guess I'm kind of looking for your department, since that's the big question out there to me is always, well, there's a line there, Senator. Why can't we just hook up there? How is your department going to start working through that process with the general public and as well with other legislators?
Well, let me start at the broad points.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator Jungbauer. I don't want to lose sight in my responsibilities of the public interest, number one. And number two, customers, consumers, and businesses. There's a lot of stakeholders and a lot of folks that are voices that need to come into play. Where you put transmission lines and the interests of the folks, the local people, there's a lot of interests that need to be considered. And not just one particular factor is going to be the answer. If you put a line up or a transmission line in my neighborhood, that might be an issue for some. And we will not lose sight of those concerns. But at the same time, I want to make sure that we take a balanced approach. And, when we want to talk about renewable energy, we need to be able to meet those needs down the line. So if there's a particular transmission line in your district or some other district or something like that, I'm open to listening to, you know, anybody and what issues. But also to make sure that we do it wisely and keep an eye on all of everybody's interests.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, let me turn to a different aspect, a different unit within our department, and this goes to Senator Brown's question, and that is the Low-Income Energy Assistance Program, LIHEAP, funded through the United States Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. With us is John Hervanko. John has been the lead in our agency in the department to administer this program. These are significant dollars. Let me just focus, at least personally and as well as generally, my philosophy. I grew up from a family where we did not have a lot of means. I may be here today because I've had a lot of opportunities, and many of us are here. And I do not want to lose sight of the fact that's where I grew up, and that's who I was in our family when we were kids. We are in a very tough economic recession. Nobody can deny, and you can't deny that. And in Minnesota, with a cold economy, an economy and the situation that we're in, a cold economy, we cannot forget that people out there in all walks of life are having a very difficult time surviving. Surviving in greater Minnesota and other areas, even in our homes. But this program is critical to a lot of people, and that focuses on children, disabled, and senior citizens. And what this program does and has done for decades is to give needed assistance dollars to help eligible households meet their energy needs, and they provide grants to reduce their energy burden and in crisis situation. There are limited funds for furnace repair or replacement and outreach and referral. Let me give you a snapshot of the funding, and John actually is exceptional at understanding these dollars. So as many of you may have heard, we last week on Wednesday, my first day on the job, received an additional allocation, the third allocation for this year in terms of the allocations. And we have $56 million, which brings the total to to date to $143 million. That money was quick. The difficulty is that we had applications already in the pipeline, so we're going to be getting these dollars out as quickly as possible to meet those application needs. There is contingency and leveraging funds unknown at this time, and that for just to give you a perspective, this goes back to 2010. We have some of the historical numbers, but the total allocation was $160 million, and you can see we're close. But I believe, John, you can correct me if we're wrong, we had six allocations. And those, so we've only had three this time. And I've been asked the question, you know, Mike, do you expect more? The difficulty is we can't divine what the federal government may or may not do. I would advocate for additional funding. And with having only received three so far, historically we tend to get more than three. We're likely to, you know, cross our fingers, may get another allocation and then at least meet a little bit of the demand and pent-up demand. And I would just reiterate that for people who are interested, that applications should be made. That if you have folks, constituents, you know, just because we may or may not meet the allocations, it's important to have those applications put in so that we know what the demand is. Next slide. Our goals for this year is to serve a record number of 175,000 households. Again, for last year, it was about 165,000. Have the benefits available to households throughout the heating season. So that extends. We're just in January, so we have a few months to go. We want to be able to serve more households that are in crisis and to serve more households needing energy-related repairs.
Commissioner.
Yes.
Senator Benson.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, Commissioner. Looks like this is all federal dollars. Please correct me if that's an incorrect assumption. Do the criteria come from the federal government or the state of Minnesota as to which households are served, number one? Number two, how much is the average grant to those households?
Sure.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I know some of the questions, but I want to turn it over to John. He's terrific at this program to get specifically your questions.
Welcome, Mr. Harvanko. Good to see you. We worked on many of these issues in the past together. So
thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
State your name, please, for the record.
John Harvanko, Director of Energy Assistance Programs. Senator, it is all federally funded. The average grant for this year is planned to be $500. And the average income is a policy set by the federal government. However, it's usually state median income, so each state it varies depending on the median income for the state. And for the state of Minnesota, for a family of four, it's $43,500. The average recipient of the program last year, household, the average income was just over $16,000. So while a family of four can meet up to $43,500, the vast majority of the households we serve are well below that 50% of state median income.
Mr. Harvanko, has the historically, how's the funding from the feds been? Is it going up? Is it steady? Is it down?
The last two federal fiscal years, prior to federal fiscal year 2011, they were at all-time records. It was $5.1 billion. And up until that point, the average was about $2 billion nationally.
How about for the state?
For the state, $2 billion, it's $78 million. For the federal fiscal year 2009, it was $164 million. And for federal fiscal year 2010, it was $160
million. Oh, you have that right there. Senator Dibble. That look.
Put a little that question look. Mark above my
yeah,
head.
That's right.
And I apologize, I stepped out for 1 second if this question has been answered. But how are the funds dispersed? Is the bill paid directly, or is it paid in the form of a cash grant to the family who then pays their energy bill?
Mr. Harvanko.
Madam Chair, Senator, The vast majority, it's the application process and the payment system is computerized and centralized. Local agencies take applications to determine eligibility, determine grant amounts, and then it's electronic fund transfer directly to the energy companies in overnight batch jobs directly to the energy companies. And the vast majority of their funds are managed that way.
Thank you.
Any glitches in the system that need fixing, Mr. Hrabenko?
I sure hope not.
Okay. Just checking.
That we've found.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, Senator Dibble.
Thanks. But I do remember, and I can't remember. I think you worked on it, this business with propane. Mm-hmm. And how we handle propane. It seems to be a little different than how we handle natural gas and electricity. Mm-hmm. Can you help us, remind us, kind of some glitchy issues in here?
Mr. Hrabenko.
Madam Chair, Senator, the economic model for delivered fuels is significantly different than the connected utilities. The connected utilities, you basically pay for the product after you use it, and delivered fuels, you need to pay for it before you use it and get delivered. So that changes, that provides some program challenges. Mm-hmm. And it puts, I think, households more closely in need of crisis assistance sooner than the connected utilities during the heating season, among other differences between those fuel sources.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner?
All right, Madam Chair, thank you. With that, I'll switch into, thank you, John. Switch into another part of the office, the State Energy Office. And as I'd indicated earlier, Janet Streff with our staff is the manager for this area as well. We have Jeremy DeFebra and Jeff Haas today. But let me give you just sort of a broad overview. The State Energy Office, again, this is a different unit in the office and has its own function and functionality and supervises a different set of programs. Its primary responsibility is to promote energy efficiency and renewable energy through financing programs, technical assistance, and public information. And with that, we have the Conservation Improvement Program, the CIP program, as well as the Federal Weatherization Assistance, State Energy and Energy Efficiency, and Conservation Block Grant programs. And the last bullet point you see there is community-based energy development, solar rebates, renewable energy production incentives. Those are broad swipes, but we're going to, in the next slide, go through some of these in a little bit more detail. On the Conservation Improvement Program, it was started in 1982. In 2007, CIP went from spending goal to a savings goal and now includes energy savings from non-traditional utility conservation activities, such as increased codes and standards compliance, electric utility infrastructure improvements, and behavioral change programs. We give you sort of some of the numbers in the next slide. Minnesota's annual natural gas expenditures are approximately $3.8 billion, or 1.78% of the state GDP. Minnesota's annual electricity expenditures are approximately $5.3 billion and 2.45% of the state GDP. The last bullet point here is to emphasize that efficiency is an indigenous resource that helps keep these dollars here at your home. We also go through in our next slide some of the savings generated by this program. Now, these are big numbers, and they do have impacts to individuals and families, homes, and our businesses. The first-year savings from 2006 to 2009 equal about 2.1 million megawatts. Cumulative savings from 06 to 09 equal about 4.9 million megawatts, the equivalent of a 196-megawatt power plant. So you can see these are some big savings. The total spending over this period has been about $420 million, which is a fraction of the cost of building this type of infrastructure. and shows you the importance of the program. Expected savings through 2015, so projected out, equal about 17.6 million megawatt hours, which is, just to put a figure on it or give you kind of a face to it, the equivalent of a 2,510 megawatt power plant. The Conservation Improvement Program, the first year savings from 2006 to 2009 from all natural gas utility SIP activities is about 7.4 million MCF, and cumulative savings equal to 19.1 million MCF. And again, to focus on the savings, it's expected through 2015 to equal 63.6 million, or 46% of the annual residential consumption. Total spending over this period has been about $74 million. Turning to a question that...
Is there any questions on the SIP program? I think, members, we are going to have a separate hearing on the Conservation Improvement Program, just because I'm hearing out there in the field that perhaps it's a good program, but it needs a little bit of tweaking. Senator Benson?
No, that was my question.
Okay. Senator Diedebel?
I was wondering when do we have that scheduled yet? Do we know?
Oh,
that?
No. No, we're not that organized, Senator Dibble. No, it's coming, but we will definitely give you a full, a lot of notice ahead of time. Anybody else?
Madam Chair and Senators, we fully recognize that each of these topics in and of themselves could be long, hearings. So we're here just to give an overview, and if there are questions in the meantime, we can facilitate those, and we're happy to be of a resource to everybody. In the next slide, we turn to another program, which is the Weatherization Assistance Program. Again, these are federal dollars, to go to Senator Brown's question earlier. The primary objectives are to reduce low-income households' energy bills by sealing air leaks, insulating walls and attics, improving furnaces, and education and outreach. The services delivered statewide are via or by local community action programs. Many of you are aware of those. The tribal councils, nonprofits, and community development corporations. To get to the dollar figures, the Weatherization Assistance Program funding is $132 million in ERA funds. At least 17,000 homes must be served with them. 12,000 households have been served to date, and it has created 500 to 600 jobs each quarter.
Is there a time that has to be used up, those dollars, Commissioner? Is there a due date?
Well, I believe they're projected to be used through the end of 2011. We have gone through somewhere between 50 and 70%. We will probably have a more specific dollar figure. But as we turn the corner from 2010 to 2011, we have accomplished maybe 60, or the department has 60 to 65%. I don't know the exact number, But again, my primary objective is to make sure that those funds get into the economy as soon as possible. I don't know. I think that's the answer, but we could get you a more specific.
Yeah. Actually, that would be nice. Thank you. Is somebody with you that could help?
Yes, absolutely. I think that is the answer, but we'll. Madam Chair, Janet Streff.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome, Ms. Streff. Your name for the record?
My name is Janet Streff. I'm manager of the State Energy Office. Madam Chair, we have a contract with the U.S. Department of Energy for using the weatherization dollars that goes through March of 2012 for the stimulus dollars. However, we anticipate spending those dollars July to September of 2011. We just received information today, and DOE is a little bit behind some of our numbers, but they're saying that we're 62.2% spent of our funds to date.
And Ms. Streff, what does exactly, it says 12,000 households served to date. What does served mean?
Madam Chair, served means that we've gone in and done an audit and then performed energy conservation measures such as the air sealing or installing a new furnace, really doing as much energy efficiency as we can so that the bills that they receive are lower.
And I assume that you won't have any problem using the rest of those dollars up. There's plenty of need out there, or is it, are you getting the people served that need to be served?
Madam Chair, we use energy assistance programs eligibility, and you heard John Harvenko speak to the number of households that he's serving, so there are plenty of households that still need to have weatherization done.
And I know Senator Brown has a question, but can you talk about how they're served also, how the funding mechanism goes through and how it's, is it a localized company, is it a state company, is it?
Madam Chair, we contract with 32 community action agencies and tribal councils, a nonprofit, and a community development corporation. They, in turn, either use crews of their own or they subcontract with contractors in their particular area. So we provide funding almost immediately. It comes from DOE through our office to their accounts through electronic funds transfer at this point. An interesting point that we've seen in our reporting to the Office of Management and Budget, and we need to report to them on a quarterly basis the number of jobs created or retained, and also we need to list the vendors that either we or our subgrantees have provided $25,000 or more to. And in the last 3 to 4 quarters, the vendors that have been that have received $25,000 or more have equaled a little over $10 million each of those quarters. So those are going into the smaller communities that are getting the work done. It's those vendors in each hometown that are getting the money to do the work. So it's been a good, interesting fact that we've seen.
Senator Brown?
My question was answered. Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Mr. F is also, if I remember our conversation from last year, it was about being able to have these companies or these vendors ramp up to that level to fulfill this obligation, and then the concern about when this money's gone, what's going to happen. Is that still an issue? Has that been addressed? And people are somewhat much more calm about it. I mean, there was some angst about getting ramped up to serve.
Madam Chair, there is still concern. We were able to accomplish the ramp up through sufficient training. Certainly we added auditors throughout the state, and there was a definite increase in the number of trainings of insulation companies to make sure that they were doing the air sealing and the insulation appropriately. There is some concern that once the weatherization dollars end, that those jobs will not be here. We have been working with our utilities as they need to continue to gain their energy savings for their program, that reaching out to homes is one good way of doing that work. So we have been working with them to try and get more homes and homeowners, but financing mechanisms that are available to encourage homeowners to go ahead and do that have not been working out, I think, as planned, not just locally or at our state, but also at a national level.
Mr. F, and to Senator Brown's question, I think what he was going to ask, are you going to have numbers on that, how many jobs were created with those dollars?
Madam Chair, Senator, you see it. I put down created between 500 and 600 jobs each quarter. Oh. And the way that the Office of Management and Budget decided to count jobs was not on a cumulative basis, but on a quarterly basis. And so each quarter it was between that number. It varied a little bit, but not a whole lot. So it wasn't that we were adding 500 jobs each quarter, but each quarter there were between 500 and 600 people working.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not sure who can answer this, so Commissioner, I'll just direct it to you.
Sure.
As we're looking at the program in general, well, I just heard we talked about auditors and ramping up. Are we going to be able to identify future needs, and if the money is not coming from the federal government out of stimulus, will we have an idea of future needs for weatherization and maybe other ways that we could shift programs, money, you know, talk about SIP, talk about other things that might be able to be shifted that way? Will we know some numbers, perhaps?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm going to ask Janet to take a look at that. She's been working with that a lot longer than I have after 3 days.
Mr. F.
Madam Chair, Senator, there's low-income weatherization that can be done, and that's what is going to be certainly ramping down. There is a certain amount of low-income funding that SIP already provides to do weatherization, and we'll continue to work with the utilities. There was a national effort this last year called PACE, or Property Assessment for Clean Energy, that almost took off and then ran into a number of roadblocks. And I think that has stopped that progress at this point. I think there are people at the national level who are still attempting to get that going, but at this point there is not an easy financing mechanism that is there so that homeowners are going to say, I'm going to access that and do that air sealing so I don't have ice dams. So we still need to get that figured out.
Senator Dibble, and then Senator Bender.
Thanks, thank you, Madam Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Streff.
Ms. Streff is a manager.
Yes.
Manager Streff. Mm-hmm. Glad you mentioned PACE, and we passed PACE legislation here in Minnesota, but it ran into those technical troubles at the federal level, and trying to sort that out, and maybe we'll be successful at that. SIP is also another potential area that we can look at, so long as it's cost effective. A couple of questions though about. The ARRA dollars represent just a huge amount, by orders of magnitude. I'm not sure how many more times in weatherization dollars than we've traditionally had on an annual basis. And so we thought it would be an opportunity to dive in and solve another couple of challenges. One is to use it for rental properties. Did we ever figure that out? Or is this confined to home ownership? The other was, there was an idea floating around to see if we couldn't take care of lead abatement issues at the same time. As long as we're in these properties, they have a similar problem. Did we ever solve that? That was a real technical problem challenge as well, because those are different streams of money and different accountabilities, but thought maybe we could dovetail those two efforts in a given household. Did we ever figure that out?
Mr. F.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, we worked on it. Certainly, the funding could always be used for rental properties, and we did request our agencies to look at how they worked with landlords in their communities and try and work more closely with them to increase the number of rental properties that were getting weatherized. We also tied that to another area, that of multifamily. A lot of rental properties are multifamily as well. And we did increase it, not as much as I think I had anticipated or hoped for, but there certainly was increased participation and I think communication, which then we can build on after the stimulus dollars leave. As far as lead abatement, our auditors need a certain amount of lead training to go into a home already. Weatherization is not a lead abatement program, however, and so we are careful as to what we find and then whether we do the weatherization at that point or whether we turn it over to another group to do the actual lead abatement. But we do have trained folks in the households looking for that.
So
Senator,
yeah, no, I understand weatherization is not lead abatement. Lead abatement is not weatherization, but there was some thought that, you know, if we needed to bring in a lead abatement crew or do some cross training, you know, make sure that we're drawing the right dollars. I mean, I'm not talking about using dollars for that which they're not intended, but you know, there was some ambition that we could address both. So, I mean, were there instances where we were able to address both issues in one household at the same time? It seemed to make sense because you're doing major work on, you know, the envelope of the building,
Mr. F.
On the window frames and the doors and et cetera.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, that's always been a possibility. So we ensured that every auditor, because we were getting new auditor in, had that particular training. And certainly if there is lead present, then we do another kind of work first, which is the lead abatement before the weatherization is done. So I don't know if there were additional numbers because of ERA and the focus that was put on it. I can certainly check that and get back to you.
Thank you.
Great. Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Strapp, how does a vendor get selected to work with you on a program, on this program?
Ms. Strapp.
Madam Chair, Senator, we have used the 32 local community action agencies and the nonprofit and the tribal communities for many, many years. The federal statute requires us to give preference to community action agencies. Those are the entities that we contract with directly. To be a vendor for to do work in the local government or the local town, they would contact their community action agency and see the kind of bidding process that exists. We did require our agencies to have a full open bidding process so that we were getting every contractor and business that might be interested involved. So I know that did occur when the money came through.
So,
Senator Vandiver.
Madam Chair, Ms. Strupp, you would say that the community action agencies were required to follow an open bidding process that most companies or qualified companies, all qualified companies could access?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, they did follow an open bidding process, and while they may do it on an annual basis, so that if they just finished it and somebody came in, they may already have their list of contractors that they're using that year. I'm not sure if they open it up every so often or not. That's really each agency's, but we do require them to have an open bidding process.
Thank you.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out that on the weatherization for rental properties, that I believe the landlord does have to sign like a one-year will not raise the rate. So the financial benefit is going to the low-income family, so they are the one that will benefit from that weatherization.
Thank you.
Is that correct?
Mr.
Madam Chair, Senator, with the stimulus money, we were not quite as stringent about that because we wanted to try and get more landlords interested. But our agencies feel pretty strongly about that, so I know every landlord is definitely encouraged to not raise that rent so that the benefit does go to the tenant.
Okay, wonderful. Commissioner?
With that, let me turn to another couple of programs here. We have the State Energy Program, SEP, and the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grants, EECBG, era funding. And then just to sort of break that out for everybody, under Chapter 138 of 2009, goes to residential energy efficiency rebates, wind, solar, and ground source heating pump rebates, commercial industrial energy efficiency grants and loans, public building efficiency and renewable energy grants, workforce development, and training. And then give you a couple more sort of the bigger figures in the dollars. There's $54 million SEP and $10 million in the EECBG. and anticipating maybe a question or two, it's 100 to 200 jobs created in the last three quarters. On the residential side, in the SEP funding, there's the Project Re-Energize, working with the Builders Association of Minnesota, Energy Savers Rebate, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. There are 4,000 homeowners who received rebates for energy-efficient window replacements, air sealing, attic and wall insulation, and furnace and AC, air conditioning replacement. Over $40 million total value of work, and more than 50,000 labor hours.
Commissioner, how did those rebates work for the homeowners?
Specific questions or details?
Were they just given a rebate form from where they bought their windows from or insulation from, and then they filled it out? And
Madam Chair, we'll...
Commissioner?
I'm going to ask Jeremy.
We're
going
to ask Jeremy DeFeber to step forward and... Again, Jeremy is the State Energy Program Supervisor.
Wonderful. Welcome, Mr. DeFebre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy DeFebre with the Office of Energy Security. The two programs, the larger of them was the Energy Savers Rebate with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and it was tied to the agency's fix-up fund loan. Applicants who secured a fix-up fund loan through their lender network could also reserve a rebate for either up 25 to 35% of qualifying costs for eligible improvements. And then upon demonstration that the work had been completed, they could then would receive a rebate. On the Project Re-Energize program, that was actually the first program that was launched with the stimulus dollars. As you may recall, there were some barriers related to determining whether we had environmental compliance and prevailing wage Davis-Bacon compliance. This one was the first one out the gate, and it was run through the Builders Association and a network of builders that essentially were a first come first serve response to their offering, and then they each were given the capacity to offer two rebates to residential customers of theirs.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jeremy.
Commissioner?
We have just a few more slides for our overview, and then, of course, if there's any more questions, we're happy to address those or get you those answers. So we have the State Energy Program. It's a federal U.S. Department of Energy formula grant since 1979. It funds core functions for the State Energy Office, and we've highlighted those here. Renewable energy and energy efficiency technical assistance, energy code support, and the Energy Information Center within our office. In operation since 1974, answering consumer energy questions on that very last bullet point. And in this last slide, we thought, well, what does that all mean? And we just threw together some of the information. But as you can see here, in timely, this happened, serious problems at our homes. Happened in my house 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago when we had those. I'm sure everybody experienced these. But to get the information, for example, on ice dams, this particular unit focuses on getting consumer information out to people and distributed by the Energy Information Center. And there's other information that the department works on as well. I wish I had this piece actually myself. So with that, that's sort of a wrap-up. It gives you a broad overview, and again, I want to express my thank you, Madam Chair, to be able to start off and on the right foot here. I appreciate the opportunity to come in, as well as to show off what I think are absolutely fabulous staff in terms of their dedication to Minnesota, their professionalism, and their ability to answer these questions and many, many more for us as Minnesotans. So with that, I'll leave it, and we can open it up for questions, or if there's anything else, we can take those back or whatever, Madam Chair. We appreciate it.
Let me just say it's an honor to have you here and to be leading this department, and they have your back, and it's a great department, and really look forward to working with your entire staff and you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. And I as well would like to say that I've always had wonderful results working with your staff. They're very easy to work with, always give me the information in a timely fashion. You talk a lot about federal money, you know, it's federal money, as though somehow it got there magically. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering in terms of, is there some way we can know in terms of Minnesota's investments, you know, it comes out of our pockets, do we get our fair share back in Minnesota? I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but are we getting the amount of money back from the federal government that we deserve? Do we know any statistical data on that?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, the answer to your question is extremely complex in terms of where the dollars come from in the federal budget. And to determine that, I imagine somebody somewhere might have an answer to that question. I don't know if that sits over in Treasury or in the White House or in Congress, CBO, whatever those agencies are. But we could try and take a crack at that and get back to you.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Well, you often wonder, too, Commissioner Senator Jungbauer, if we were in charge of that money, if we could make the guidelines and the rules, how much different we would do it than what comes down from the feds, and how more efficient we could use the dollars. Sometimes wonder. I bet you we could. Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I want to echo the welcome and pleased that the commissioner himself is here at our committee. It's a great honor. Although we've enjoyed spending a lot of time with the deputy commissioner and his predecessor, but to have the actual commissioner of the agency here is great in the Energy Committee. just a quick question. We can even delay it until we have the SIP day here. But I remember a couple of other activities that were called for in the bill when we passed it. So I'd just be curious to know what's happening. One was to serve as kind of a clearinghouse of information of different sorts of energy efficiency and energy conservation measures that utilities could turn to, whether those were market mechanisms or transmission generation, consumer incentives, et cetera, because there's a lot of products, et cetera. A lot of good ideas out there, and just wondering if that function is being fulfilled. The other was to do some applied research or some pilots or stuff like that, and we had dedicated some specific resources for that purpose out of the bill. Rate, dollars that come from rates, of course, but still dollars applied for that purpose. And I haven't been updated on any of that of late. So,
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Senator, if you don't mind, I would like to take those are good questions, mm-hmm. very good questions, and take those back and ask staff to come up with the answers, and maybe either at another hearing or we can. I'll get back to you on those kinds of questions.
Great.
They're important questions, and also, Madam Chair, to your point about the ERA funds, I don't want it to be left unsaid though that. At a critical point in the economic downturn, that a lot of these funds were at least brought to Minnesota, and they're a great opportunity for us to use them in terms of helping develop jobs. Jobs are very important for us in that in terms of our local economies, small businesses and, single contractors are out there looking for an ability to help. And I think that at this point it was important to see us through a little bit. And as we come through the recession and get out of it, we're dedicated at the department, I am, to focus on things we can do to help businesses and customers get through the recession and get back on track to where we were headed and where we will head to, one, be a better to move from good, and we are great in many areas in our agency and in our state, but also in our economy and for the business sector as well.
And Commissioner, with that, the if you and your department, and you've got some great minds there, if you can think of things that we need to look at in this committee, and I know you mentioned smart grid, but anything else that comes to mind that we should really address, please let myself know or Peter. And if there's information that you can share with Senator Dibble, but make sure that
absolutely
Mr. Mavis gets it so we can share it with the entire committee. I'd appreciate that.
Madam Chair, absolutely.
I do have one question, though. It's on the Energy Information Center.
Yes.
You've been in operation since 1974, answering consumer energy questions. So just out of curiosity, how are those changing, those questions?
Yeah, I'm sorry, the door slammed. Can you?
just on the question. Energy Information Center, since 1974 it's been in operation, and I was just wondering what the trend is on those questions lately, and if it's still being used.
Oh, that's a very good question. Yeah, why don't we have, is somebody, Jeremy? Well, let me just start off this way. I mean, in 1974, I think,
I wasn't even born yet.
I was just trying to think myself.
Yeah. They're all laughing.
But I do remember, debating in high school, the energy topic was 1979. And at that point, it was a serious problem with the OPEC embargo. And those questions in 1974 were significant, serious. As you remember, President Carter looked at conservation throughout the economy. But in any event, I imagine things have changed. You know, ice dams are important. They always have been important. But maybe Jeremy has a little more detail on that.
Mr. DeFebe.
Madam Chair, when Commissioner told me that he was debating the energy issues in 1979, I told him that I started at the Minnesota Energy Agency in 1979. I'm not quite sure how he took that.
That's good.
And I started in the Energy Information Center at that time.
No kidding.
And worked in there for about 3 years. Uh-huh. And there were many things that were different. We were dealing with gas rationing, gas lines, helping people steer if they wanted to go up north where they could buy gas on the way. We were dealing with what was then emergency building temperature restrictions that were imposed by the federal government and were nearly inexplicable, and it was our job to explain them. But there are many, many things that are exactly the same. How do you insulate your walls? What's the best way to go? What's the best approach to take to insulate your roof? How do you judge a good window? What about solar? What about wind?
So the information center is getting used a lot. Is that something that's steady or increasing more now with the
Madam Chair, it is getting used significantly. I think the methods of accessing information have changed significantly. In about 1982, 1981, we maxed out with, I believe, about 6 or 7 people answering phones for consumers. We have usually just one person answering the phone now, okay, with somebody to back up. Mm-hmm. So a great deal of web-based information gets used.
Going back and forth on the web.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Madam Chair, and also, it's my goal to make sure that web-based information is maximized to the extent possible so that the public has access to that. And I know it's there now. But also, whatever outreach we can do, we'll do that with the resources that we have.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, part of your mission statement talks about promoting reliable energy. Can you explain to us where does the agency monitor, whether it be a distribution system or a facility, when it may be getting into regulatory difficulty or safety-related issues? Is that outside your agency's purview, or do you closely monitor that?
Madam Chair, Senator, Kay will come up and deal with that. But I'll just let Kate do it. I was going to give you a snippet, but Kate, go ahead.
Ms. O'Connell.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, there's actually two different functions that we use to do that. I don't remember when the legislation was passed, but there was legislation passed saying that utilities had to file reports on the distribution component of their systems so that they had to show that it was reliable, how many outages there were, what was happening with that. We've been looking at that and monitoring that. When they have outages that are are very significant. They have to report to us and report to the Public Utilities Commission. That's actually for both gas and electric utilities. And actually, there's another way that we look at the overall reliability for electric utilities. We look at the transmission system and the generation and the load. So that's what happens in the resource plans, those integrated resource plans. We look at whether the utilities actually have adequate facilities in place to meet the projected load from their customers over time, because those facilities can't be put in place instantly. We have to be able to be ready for those. So I think with the planning and the holding the utilities accountable to the plans that they have, looking at demand-side management as well, how are the utilities using that? Are they being fair? Are they operating their systems reliably? All of those things come into play in various places. I think reliability is obviously cost-effective, and having reasonable rates is critical, especially for an economy that's struggling. Reliability, I think, is even more critical. So it is part of everything that we do.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Sarah. Senator DeDebel.
Thanks, and to those on the committee who are interested, there are specific standards of reliability expectations, as was shared, and I've had some experience around this, and representing constituents have been frustrated with more than frequent outages. A lot of those issues have been addressed, but I would encourage you to have conversations with the office and the PUC if that's something you're experiencing in your community, if you want to deliver specific information to your constituents about what they can expect or what they should be able to expect.
Good point, Senator. Yeah. What a great discussion. Well, that was a fun committee. You've got a great
job, wonderful.
Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. You too.
Yes. Are there any further questions from the committee? We are going to be talking Thursday about jobs and energy. And we'll let you know a little further what's on the agenda, but that's the main premise of Thursday's discussion. And, of course, the nuclear moratorium is next week. We'll have Tuesday we'll have discussion about it and testimony, and then Thursday will be amendments and a vote. Okay. Again, thank you, Commissioner, and to all your departments for coming in. It's really a pleasure to meet you, and congratulations.
Thank you.
And
you
if there's no further comments, the meeting is adjourned.